ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Trump versus the Ivy League. What's the truth in the battle over bias on campus? Hello there, this is the Religion and Ethics Report. Andrew West on ABC Radio National, ABC Listen, and across the Pacific on Radio Australia. And that story is soon. Pope Leo flies east next week. It'll be his inaugural overseas trip as pontiff. First stop, Turkey, a country where the Christian population has dwindled to less than 1%. He'll meet the ecumenical patriarch Bartholomew, who leads most of the world's Orthodox Christians. He'll also meet the controversial president of Turkey, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. He's been styling himself as a new sultan of the broader Islamic world. But it's the second leg of Leo's trip to Lebanon that's potentially more challenging. Christians are around a third of the population, but there are real fears that external actors, including Iran and Israel, could destabilize a fragile religious settlement that's barely survived for more than 30 years. Dr. Rula Talhouk is the director of the Institute for Muslim Christian Studies at St. Joseph's University in Beirut.
His visit to Turkey is to celebrate 1,700 years of Council of Nicea, and it's the first dogmatic council of the Holy Church. His visit to Lebanon is a little bit different. He was asked by our president of the republic to come to Lebanon because, you know, our community, Christian community, not only Catholic, but all the Christian in Lebanon are in a big fear now. We have been living in war since 1975, and now the situation is very critical. And I'm not talking about Israel, I'm talking about Iran. Because there is a will to kick out the Christian from this era. And if the Christian are out of Lebanon, they will be out of any other Arab country. Mm. So I think that his visit is strategic.
That's very alarming, the scenario that you raise. Do we know what Leo is going to say to the government of Lebanon?
The Holy See isn't declaring anything. Even the government don't know what will be their part of the preparation. Mm. We have the feeling that he is coming to support us. But in a political level, we need more. We need a reform in our system, in our political system. The system is corrupt. The politicians are corrupt. They are helping each other to stay in the government. It's not about to change one or two persons from the system. The whole system is corrupted. Unfortunately, our religious leaders are corrupted also.
You mentioned there the very specific threat that you say comes from Iran, a country very close by. What is the state of Christian-Muslim relations in Lebanon today, though? Because a kind of peace has held over several decades. Can you put aside the external threat and say what is the existing state of relations in the country?
Okay, there is different levels. On a basic level of life, there is a very good relation between Muslim and Christian because we are living together from decades, as you say. On a daily basis, we are together in all fields of work, especially in the big cities as Beirut. We are here like 2.5 million people living together and making all things together. There is no difference. The problem is with the new Islamic movement. And I'm saying new to make a difference between the Muslim of Lebanon and the new Islamic movement, because we have branches of Al-Qaeda and Daesh now in the north of Lebanon. This is a big issue for us. And we have the movement of Hezbollah, and it's a political movement also, dogmatic movement also. So we have both from Shia and Sunni, new movement in Lebanon, like about 40 years. go, and it's very difficult to live with them, to make politics with them. We don't have the same strategic, we don't have the same economic ideas, but we are in a very, very, very difficult period. Now we are waiting for the new attack, Israel attack. And this time it will cover the whole country.
Yes.
Not only in the south and the Bekaa.
How sure are you, though, of another attack by Israel? What would prompt another attack by Israel?
Because Hezbollah is gaining health and wealth and new weapons from the behalf of Iran through Syria. This year, the American said that Hezbollah has taken $1 billion in 2025. And we know that they are working on themselves. And each day we have new attacks in the south and in the Bekaa. They are putting their biggest troops on the border with the south and the Bekaa. Mm-hmm. And this is very alarming. And yesterday they attacked the UNIFIL.
What could Pope Leo do to defuse this situation during his visit? Is there anything he could do?
No. Unfortunately, no, not with Israel, not with Trump, not with Iran. But he can give us strength in the community. He can help the church itself. But in geopolitics, I don't know if he has any power on this.
He may not have power to influence Israel or even Iran. But, ruler, isn't it the case that you've said there are local Muslim communities, about two-thirds of the population in Lebanon, that have tried to live in good coexistence? Could Pope Leo not influence the leadership of the local Sunni and Shia communities?
Yes and no. So, as I said, with the original Sunni and Shia in Lebanon, there is no problem. Problem is with the influenced communities, influenced by Iran or influenced by a very Islamic tough movement in the world. We have more than two communities, regular Muslims and Lebanese Muslim and other that are aiming to stand for an ummah, the ummah.
Yes, that is the global Islamic community.
Yes, those people don't believe in any country or any other Sharia laws than theirs.
You've mentioned there's a presence from Daesh or ISIS, the Islamic State,
yes,
but also Al-Qaeda. Are these groups attempting to overthrow the very fragile settlement in Lebanon? Is that part of their plan? Or are they just there because they've been driven out of Iraq and Syria?
They are driven by Syria mainly now. And as you know, President Sharia was in the United States and he signed to be against all these movements. The problem is they are not here only to attack the Lebanese army. They are here to attack Hezbollah. And this is very complicated because it will help Hezbollah to regain in his strength, because it's like he gives himself a reason to stay and his weapons to remain his weapons. Because each time he will say to his bases, see, there is a threat from the north, and this is Sunni who wants to kill Lebanese and who wants to kill Shia. And as the Lebanese army is weak, I won't give up on my weapons to defend Lebanon and the Shia. Mm. And I think it's a vicious circle.
I have read where some Christian communities in the past have sought some protection from Hezbollah against the growth of these Sunni fundamentalists. Is that still the case?
Not in Lebanon. But in Syria, yes.
Is there anything at all that Pope Leo can do to calm the situation? You say that his influence may be limited with the Israelis and with the Iranians. What can he say to the world about Lebanon in particular?
You know, Pope John Paul II said that Lebanon is a mission for the whole world, and especially in the Middle East. He will say the same. Because it's a real threat for all the Middle East if the Christians have been kicked out of Lebanon or have been kicked out of politics. because we are the only democratic, and our Lebanon is the only free in politics and in democracy. We have the only system in the Arab world where people can give their ideas, and we are free to say whatever we want. If Christian out of Lebanon, it will be the end of all the Middle East. There will be another war, and a big war, between Shia and Sunni.
Is Lebanon the only thing at the moment that you think stands between a war between the Shia and the Sunni?
Yes.
That's very dramatic.
The Christian in Lebanon, because Christian in other Arab countries are not free, and they are not involved in politics and in economic life. They are very weak communities.
Dr. Rula Talhouk, she's the director of the Institute of Christian Muslim Studies at St. Joseph's University in Beirut. Thank you for joining us on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Thank you. Thank you a lot.
And you're on ABC Radio National, hearing about the links between religion and the news that shapes the world. For President Donald Trump, there are few more inviting targets than America's universities. Ivy League institutions, including Harvard, Columbia, and the University of Pennsylvania, have lost federal funds and been subject to more direct government control. Now, the administration says it's trying to combat the leftist domination of campus. Philosophy professor Yuval Avnur of Scripps College and two colleagues, Stephanie Maravchek and John Shields, have been especially worried about these attacks. So they began to investigate the allegations of bias in university and college courses. They've published part of their results in the online journal Persuasion.
Probably the most alarming thing that got the three of us talking is just the dismal numbers in the public opinion polls in the U.S. on the level of trust and confidence in higher education, just in the general public. We were really interested in, first of all, figuring out why that is, but also trying to figure out whether some of the common complaints about higher education were true. In the U.S., we're seeing right now what I would describe as an unprecedented attack on institutions of higher education by the current administration. There may be problems in higher education, and they seem to be exploited in the current political climate to do, I'm afraid, some real damage to these institutions that we love. So all three of us are coming from a place of deep respect for the university. We want to protect it. Part of protecting it is seeing where it can be improved, getting real evidence one way or another about what the problem is and how to fix it is the first step towards restoring the public trust in our institutions. In no way do we want or did we plan for our results to fuel the current attack on higher education. In fact, that train left the station long before we even found any of our results.
So let's look at three areas that you examined where you and your co-authors say there's just insufficient debate. It's lopsided. They're the questions of race relations in the US, Israel and Palestine, and the ethics of abortion. Before we go into the findings, briefly tell us about the texts that you looked at and why.
We actually think there is a very healthy debate among scholars on all of these issues. The problem is really whether that debate or how that debate is taught in the classroom. We looked at a number of texts on each of the three issues. On the subject of race and criminal justice, we looked at what is pretty clearly the dominant text on the topic, which is Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow. This text is assigned in the database of syllabi that we used for our study, just thousands of times. It's really one of the most widely assigned texts in the humanities in general. On the topic of Israel-Palestine, we looked at Edward Said's Orientalism, which actually is not a book about the Israel-Palestine issue. He does go into the Israel-Palestine issue and frames it in a way that has been extremely influential in not only the scholarly discussion that followed Orientalism, the book, but also the rest of the scholarly literature on it. And then on the topic of abortion, it was Judith Thompson's classic essay on the ethics of abortion, which is also by a pretty large margin the most often assigned work. This is an essay, not a book, on the topic of the ethics of abortion. Mm.
Let's talk about Michelle Alexander's book first, The New Jim Crow. Sure. She said that after equality legislation was passed in the United States, those seeking to uphold racial discrimination then sought to use the criminal justice system to do that. But it seems to me it was actually some black scholars that pushed back against her, wasn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. Some of the first and most prominent voices were other black scholars in the U.S. Foreman Jr. is the one that I believe we discussed in the persuasion piece. He, of course, is no fan of the criminal justice system, but he claimed that her historical claims were off and the lessons that she inferred from them were off. And he made what many saw was a pretty persuasive criticism of the main thrust of her book. Despite this, he is assigned just a fraction of the time when Michelle Alexander's book is assigned. So you see a prominent, certainly I would say left of center, black scholar, highly cited, works at the Yale Law School, I believe, hardly ever assigned with the dominant text.
There's a statistic that leapt out at me. You said 97% of courses that assign Michelle Alexander's important book, The New Jim Crow, do not include any response from James Foreman in his book. James Foreman, as you said, of the Yale Law School, they don't include any of his response. What's the consequence of that, Yuval?
One consequence that I find particularly troubling, if we look at what's the consequence for the students who are in these classes, is that they may well come away with the impression that there is a scholarly consensus on this important issue when there isn't. So why is that so important? It's important because the student then goes on into society thinking that anyone who disagrees on this point is just an uneducated ignoramus, and there's no point in, you know, debating with them. It's, you know, hey, look, all of the experts, all the people who are most knowledgeable on this topic already agree, this student will come away thinking. There's no point in debating and engaging in dialogue with those who disagree with it. In this case, that's just not true. There are plenty of extremely knowledgeable people, people who care deeply about the issue too, who disagree with this dominant viewpoint. So that's one bad consequence. And I have to mention another bad consequence of a different sort. This involves the general public. A consequence of not teaching a real scholarly controversy when there is one is that eventually the public learns about it. The public suspects that what we're doing in these classrooms is not representing the reasonable range of views on this important topic. And so they lose trust in the university system. Now, I don't mean to suggest, just to be clear, that the way this particular text is taught is responsible for the lack of trust in higher education, but this kind of approach to teaching in higher education, of which this is a notable example, does contribute to the lack of trust in higher education. And I do think that that directly or indirectly leads to the kind of attack on higher education we're seeing now. It leads to a culture where meaningful debate is stifled or it just doesn't happen because a good chunk of the people who are supposed to be highly educated think that there is a consensus when there is none. Mm.
Let's talk now about Edward Said's book, Orientalism. Not strictly, as you say, just about the Israel-Palestine tension or conflict. It was Said's critique of the way the West viewed the Middle East and non-Western cultures. How widely is it read? But more pointedly, in your study, how widely is it debated? How widely is it contested in classrooms?
There are very few texts in the same category of critical theory or literary criticism that have been as influential as Edward Said's Orientalism. It's an extremely influential book. He was an extremely influential person. It should be assigned. It should be read widely. It's a classic. But how often is he taught with critics of his approach, with critics of the various and many claims that he makes in the book, or just with sort of alternative ways of approaching the topic, we found in our study of syllabi, the answer is really not very often. By far, the texts that you will find co-assigned with Edward Said's Orientalism are fellow travelers. You see a lot of Foucault, you see a lot of Judith Butler, and other critical theory luminaries.
There was a riposte written some years later to Orientalism. It was called Occidentalism. It was by Ian Baruma, who's been on this program a couple of times, and Ivashai Margalit. I mean, it really tried to get a debate going in this field about colonialism. Did that debate ever take off?
In a lot of ways, it did take off in the academic world. We should also mention Bernard Lewis's criticisms of Edward Said. In fact, I think Said and Lewis actually engaged in very widely attended public debate about the topic. And Lewis published his criticisms, of course, subsequently. None of these are taught alongside Edward Said's book, hardly ever at all. Your question, though, was whether their criticisms sparked debate in the field. Absolutely, they did. I think Orientalism has always been contested from a variety of angles.
Here on the Religion and Ethics Report with me, Andrew West, we're speaking with Professor Yuval Avnor of Scripps College, along with his colleagues John Shields and Stephanie Moravcek. He's the author of an analysis about the narrow range of courses and the narrow range of texts that are studied in some American colleges. Let's deal finally, Yuval, and this was a surprise to me, I have to say, with the famous essay by Judith Thompson, The Defense of Abortion. You actually found that there was a lot more debate in university curriculums about this article. First of all, why was this article so seminal?
It's seminal primarily because it's so brilliant. The thought experiment is so immediately accessible to the student. The argument is at least initially compelling and intuitive. Judith Thompson herself was kind of a force of nature in the field. It's no surprise, really, looking back, I don't think, that it became a classic of philosophy.
But why have professors been more open to providing an alternative viewpoint to this essay? And you have found this, of all the three areas that you studied, you found that there was more openness to debate on the question of abortion. I mean, what's the reason for that?
We don't have any indication of the professors' motives, of the motives of the administrators that oversee these curriculums. But I think in this case, we have a pretty good idea. If you look at the breakdown of what courses a student will encounter this text in, overwhelmingly it's in philosophy departments. Philosophy as a discipline is kind of all about considering arguments and then considering objections to the arguments. So I think there's kind of a built-in presumption that we're going to debate this already in the very discipline of philosophy. I have to say that not only did we find that people assign alternative views, that is, arguments for the contrary position, pro-life arguments in these classes, whether they engage directly with Judith Thompson or not. We also found that she's often assigned with texts that provide alternative theoretical backgrounds to the one that Judith Thompson appeals to in that essay. So in other words, the impression you get when you look at the patterns in these syllabi is that students who encounter this dominant text, I think it's fair to characterize it as a pro-choice text, will also encounter ideas about morality itself that will help them think critically about her argument, that will help them consider why might someone reject this or that premise of the argument. We find that the text is assigned, for example, with classic works of utilitarianism, which is a theory of morality that arguably runs counter to the kind of considerations that Thompson puts forward in her article. So I think it's because the essay appears in philosophy classes, and I think philosophy classes will tend to be more organized around debates and disputes.
One of the arguments, I guess, that your critics might say is these works by Thompson, by Edward Said, by Alexander, they're unique in their insights. They shouldn't be flattened out by just being melded into some other part of a debate. They stand above all the other texts in the field. You do deal with that criticism. What do you say?
We do, and it's a criticism that we hear a lot. I would begin by conceding something there. These are great texts, so they deserve, arguably, to serve as the anchor for a discussion, for a conversation when you're getting educated about this topic, whatever the topic may be. There's a couple of different versions that it's important to disentangle here. There are a couple of different versions of this objection. On one version, as you say, we shouldn't muddy the waters too much by introducing these critical texts, because these dominant texts, whoever it is, Said or Alexander, they basically got it right, and we need to teach students the truth. There was a philosopher, a thinker not long ago by the name of J.S. Mills on Liberty. He, I think, dealt pretty handily with the view that all we ever need to hear is what we know to be the truth. In the first place, it's pretty arrogant to think that we're infallible on these pretty complicated issues, so infallible that we know that these texts have completed the work of wisdom on the topic. But moreover, there's a lot of value in considering objections to a view, even when you think that the view is true, not only because it helps you to understand and actually know the view that you take to be true by considering objections to it, but because as a student, when you go out into society and you encounter people who disagree with you on these topics, and with these three topics, you will encounter people that you share a society with who disagree with you deeply about these topics, you need to have thought about and thought carefully about their objections, their point of view, and how to critically engage with them. If we take higher education seriously as a sort of training for citizenship and for engagement in civic life, the education needs to include consideration of views that one will encounter in society and in political life, especially when the people who have the most knowledge about it themselves don't agree about it.
Yuval Avnor, he's a professor of philosophy at Scripps College, along with two colleagues, John Shields and Stephanie Moravchik. They've written a paper, Closed Classrooms, an Analysis of College Syllabi on Contentious Issues. We'll put a link to it at our website. There's also a summary at the fascinating online magazine called Persuasion. Yuval, thank you for joining us on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Thank you for considering these important topics on your show.
That's it for this episode. Next week, a report from the front lines of America's immigration wars.
Yeah, so every protest that I've been in, especially a protest led by faith leaders, there's been no violence. What I can say is that immediately we are met with physical assault and violence. I've been met with physical violence several times. A photo that I'm sure some of your viewers have seen, I am grabbed after having told folks that I mean them absolutely no harm, that we're peaceably assembled, and I'm slammed to the ground and treated quite roughly. I would say that how I'm treated, I want to keep the focus on the detainees. How I'm treated is 1/100th or 1/1000th of what goes on in that facility. But all the violence I've ever experienced has been from ICE agents, and it's also been from Illinois State Police, but it's been from law enforcement officials who are part of this administration. But a narrative that says that faith leaders are somehow out there being violent, it's just, it's fatuous.
That story is next week. You can follow us at ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. A big thanks to producer Mandy Roberts and audio panel beater Roy Huberman. I'm Andrew West. Join us again for the Religion and Ethics Report.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.